So, good evening. Let's start with our motivation. And bring our mind to what our task is at this present moment. So, what are we supposed to be doing right now? What do we have the privilege and benefit of doing right now, and bring our mind to that. So we're not thinking about what just happened or what we want to do, or worrying about something else. We're paying attention to what our task is at this present moment, which is generating bodhicitta, so that we can have a very expansive, extensive, noble motivation for listening to the teachings. And then actually listening to the teachings and thinking about them in such a way that we can remember them and integrate them into our lives. So it's not time for distraction, it's not time for falling asleep. So I think this can be very helpful to us throughout the day at any particular time to check in and ask ourselves if we're doing what needs to be done at this particular moment. And so, with a mind reaching out to each and every living being, wanting to benefit them, to repay their kindness, and to lead them to the kind of happiness that will really fulfill them. And we cultivate our motivation and listen to the Gomchen Lamrim. So there were some questions that came from our Singaporean friends that I wanted to address first of all. So one of the questions that they wrote, which is a very good question, it comes up a lot, is what's the difference between the self-centeredness and the self-grasping ignorance? Okay. So we kind of covered this a little bit last week, but to go over it again. Okay, so self-grasping ignorance, that's the ignorance that grasps ourselves and all phenomena as inherently existent. It's the root of samsara, and it's what has to be eradicated in order to attain liberation. And, of course, to attain full awakening as well. Okay? So the antidote to the self-grasping ignorance is the wisdom that realizes emptiness. Okay? So here, self can mean the person, grasping the person as inherently existent. It can also, sometimes self means inherent existence. So self-grasping ignorance becomes the ignorance grasping at inherent existence. Okay, the word self has two very different meanings. You have to figure out what it means in any particular situation. Okay, but this is an afflictive obscuration that is counteracted by wisdom and needs to be eliminated to attain either liberation or full awakening. Yeah, the self-centered mind, technically speaking, is the mind that cherishes our own liberation rather than other beings' liberation, or more than other beings' liberation. So this is a mind that says, I want to attain nirvana, but for myself alone. I don't want to do the extra work that it takes to become a Buddha for the benefit of sentient beings. Okay? So this mind, yeah, is counteracted by love and compassion and bodhicitta. Yeah, it's not counteracted by the wisdom realizing emptiness. And the self-centered thought is not an afflictive obscuration. You can attain liberation having that self-centered thought. That's what the arhats have. So it's unlike the self-grasping ignorance that's the root of samsara and needs to be eliminated to attain liberation. But to attain full awakening, the self-centered thought definitely needs to be eliminated. Yeah, because we can't become a Buddha without having the bodhicitta mind. And the bodhicitta mind is the direct counterforce to the self-centered mind. Okay? Yeah. Sometimes when we talk about self-centeredness in a very, very general way, then we include in it all of our attachment and our anger and, you know, all the craziness in our mind that causes us to create negative karma and keeps us in samsara. So technically speaking, that isn't the technical meaning of self-centeredness, but often we include everything in that because when we look at our actions created under the influence of attachment or anger or jealousy or something like that, they all have that self-centered backing of, you know, my happiness is the most important and take care of me first. Okay? So, me first. Remind you of something? So, So, you know, we certainly need to overcome both of those minds to attain Buddhahood, but they're quite different minds, quite different states of mind, okay? Then the second question they asked was for resources for meditation on the different themes, you know, meditations that were that correspond to the teachings that we're getting. So I would recommend in the easy path that we did right before this text, it was written as if it were a meditation manual. And so it has like a verse, or not a verse, but a whole paragraph or two paragraphs that you can recite. And then you contemplate along with what that paragraph describes. So that's a very good way to do the meditations on these different things. Also, if you get the book Guided Meditations on the Stages of the Path, there's in it, and also on the website, a Lamrim meditation guideline, with the basic meditations and all the meditation points under them. And in the book, Guided Meditation on the Stages of the Path, there's also a CD with me leading the meditations. And for people who no longer have machines that take CDs, it'll tell you where to download it on your tablet or your iPod or whatever from the web. Okay. And then what you really want to get in the habit of doing is to learn how to read a passage in a book and then from it make your own meditation outline. Okay? And so, you know, if whatever topic you're reading about is well written, you know, then each paragraph should have either, you know, a topic sentence or a concluding sentence or something like that, so that you should be able to pick out the important points that, if it's, again, well written, are following in a sequence that help you develop a certain thought. And so to learn how to pick those points out of a passage you read and just write them down so that you know the points to contemplate. Okay? And so that's very, very helpful because it teaches you to pay attention to what you're reading. It helps you pick out the important points. And then when you meditate, you're able to stay on track because you've read something that's an elaborate explanation, but you just have the main points written down, but you remember the elaborate explanation and you contemplate that while you're meditating on the main points. Yeah. And then, of course, as always, it's very helpful to make examples of the main points you're meditating on and make examples, you know, from your own life or from what you've seen around you. In other words, make that teaching something very personal to yourself. Okay, so we're not just contemplating dry facts or abstract principles. We're applying them to what we've witnessed and experienced in life and checking to see, you know, if they're true or not, and checking to see if we change the way we're thinking according to those different points or see the situation according to the different points to see if that helps us loosen our afflicted mental states. Okay? So you kind of try those things out and try working with them yourself. Okay? Is this making some sense to you? Yeah? So, you know, we've just gone through the last 2 weeks a lot about the self-centered mind and the benefits of cherishing others. Yeah. So with the self-centered mind, you know, write a list of all the disadvantages of it and then look in your own life. Yeah. So, you know, self-centered mind, you're a thief. You steal my virtue. Okay. Well, is that true? When I'm self-centered, am I able to create virtue? Yeah. Well, no, but why not? What are some examples of how my self-centeredness prevented me from creating virtue? What are some examples?
Self-preoccupation.
Yeah, no, I want specific in your life examples. We're doing a group meditation now. You know, exactly how you do it when you're doing it individually. Yeah? So the first point is, you know, self-centeredness prevents me from creating virtue. So how, you ask yourself, how in my life has self-centeredness prevented me from creating virtue? What are some examples? Yeah.
Being asked to help out with friends or at the Dharma Center and having had my own plans and choosing to do that instead because valuing my own plans more than helping others.
Mm. Okay, so that's a good example. Yeah? What's another example?
Being preoccupied with the outcome that I wanted and then speaking harshly to someone who I was perceiving as getting in my way.
Yeah, okay. Another good example. Okay, self-centeredness. What's another disadvantage of it?
Small incidences in my life that are trivial, making huge dramas out of them where I'm the center of the universe.
Okay, good. So that's a disadvantage. What are some personal examples of that?
Feelings of guilt. Guilt afterwards.
Uh-huh. Okay, so you felt guilt after something you did or something you didn't do.
Yeah, I rolled the microphone yesterday on the floor. And today I got a paper, so I'm feeling pretty guilty right now.
Being upset about something that somebody did when thinking that they did it to be disrespectful or piss me off, and when they probably didn't notice me at all.
Okay.
Or notice that I was upset about it.
Yeah, so that's another good example, making mountains out of molehills. Yeah. So do you see what I'm getting at? Yeah, how to do the meditation? Yeah. So let's take this is just an example. We're not going to do the whole meditation. Then, you know, the benefits of cherishing others. Okay, so what's one benefit of cherishing others? Okay, you create lots of merit. So what's some examples, personal examples, of how you can create merit by cherishing others? Something that you want to put into practice, that you want to do.
When somebody is sick, taking care of them, bringing them food and helping them out.
Okay, good. So you see what I'm getting at? We don't want just general ideas. We want specific things, because that will make the meditation very rich and will show you exactly what you can do to put the meditation into practice. Okay, what's another benefit of cherishing others?
We can rejoice in their welfare and when good things happen to them, and we can have joy in our...
So we can feel happy when good things come to them, happen to others. So that's a benefit. So what are some instances where you can do that?
You see someone be praised.
Not someone. I want to hear specific. When I see so-and-so do this and that.
Helping someone to learn English, and then they go and apply for a driver's license.
Yeah, very good.
But Venerable Jampa asked to go to Hong Kong, to the community, and the community say, yeah, go, it's a good experience. And that's a way to rejoice that that's something that we know would be helpful and benefiting.
Mm-hmm. So. Right. Okay. So are you getting what I'm saying? Yeah. If you leave your example with, you know, helping somebody when they need help, that won't wake you up so that you help somebody when they need help. Yeah. But when you say, give yourself specific things that you can do to help, yeah, then it gives you, you know, some momentum there. Of course, you can see when other opportunities come to help. But do you get what I'm saying about the specific things that really make the meditation very tasty for you? Okay. Or, for example, if we're meditating on, we're doing the analytical meditation on the disadvantages of cyclic existence, yeah? And one of the disadvantages is that there's no satisfaction, okay? So what are some examples that you can make from your own life experience that illustrate that there's no satisfaction in cyclic existence?
I would say trying to set my dream job with my dream career with my best friend and setting up a practice and putting all my energy and time into it, and it didn't really work.
Yeah. Okay. So that's a very clear example. Yeah. Another example of things being unsatisfactory in samsara.
Six chocolate chip cookies.
Yeah. And a stomach ache.
And a stomach ache.
Okay. So, but also look a little bit deeper than the chocolate chip cookies, you know? Are there things that you've really wanted that you've gotten that have left you feeling dissatisfied at the end?
Going to a different country thinking it's going to be better, and then getting a degree thinking everything's going to be better after that. Then getting a real job thinking everything's going to be better after that. Getting a stable relationship thinking everything's going to be better after that. Breaking off. Getting an apartment for myself, thinking everything's going to be better after that. Thinking I'm going to attain single point of concentration in 3 months and thinking everything is going to be better after that.
Good examples.
But things might be better after the 1 month retreat.
Okay, let's wish him well, okay? Yeah. Okay. So, so this is some kind of example, you know, if we were, of how to do it when you're in silent meditation yourself. Here we were passing the microphone and doing it. But I wanted to, make sure you have the idea of what you're supposed to be doing, okay?
So for act of cherishing others, someone says, in a long line at the grocery store, let someone else go in front of you. Or get a warm cup of coffee for someone standing outside in the cold who has no money. And someone said, for rejoicing, they're rejoicing in those who are at the Abbey for winter retreat. I want to be there but can't. So rejoicing that others are there. And other people went, yes!
Okay, very good. This explanation in transforming adversity of the how to do the taking and giving meditation is the best that I've ever encountered, the most detailed one that I've encountered. So I really recommend it. If you look on the website for the people online, there's a description, there's a couple of articles written on it, on how to do it. But this one in Transforming Adversity into Joy and Courage is very, very thorough in the explanation. Okay, so so this meditation actually has a root in one of the sutras that is called Pamoche Norzengi Nampar Tapar. So it's some kind of biography of somebody. Okay? And so in that, the Buddha taught about taking on the suffering of sentient beings and giving them your happiness. Also in Precious Garland, in a verse in the 5th chapter, we haven't come to it yet, but one of the lines reads, may all negativities ripen upon me, and may all my happiness and virtue ripen upon other sentient beings. So that is seen as a root, actually, for the whole equalizing, exchanging self with others practice, which culminates in taking and giving. And also Shantideva in engaging in the Bodhisattva's deeds, I changed my translation of the title, says that if we don't exchange self and others, taking this on the suffering of others and giving them their happiness, we won't become a Buddha. But if we do that, then attaining full awakening is definitely possible. Okay. So that makes it pretty necessary to do, doesn't it? Yeah. But this meditation does not suit everybody at necessarily where they're at right now. So if this meditation doesn't feel comfortable to you, there's no push to do it. Okay, you have to do it when it feels comfortable, when it's meaningful to you. Because what we're imagining doing here is taking on the suffering of others with a feeling of great compassion, kind of saying, I'm going to bear their pain and misery and the three kinds of dukkha so that they can be free of that. And then I want to multiply and transform, or transform and multiply my body's possession and merit, and give that to all other beings so that they can have their temporal needs and samsara fulfilled, as well as their ultimate needs with their long-term spiritual realizations fulfilled.
Did the Buddha encourage everyone to be a bodhisattva? And if he didn't, why not?
I think the Buddha, because the Buddha was able to see people's individual dispositions and interests and tendencies, he taught them according to those. So in the long term, he wanted everybody to become a Buddha, which means becoming a bodhisattva first. But in the short term, if he saw that some people weren't ready for that, then he taught them what they were ready for, what was meaningful to them, and how to attain their personal liberation from samsara. Okay? So this gets into the discussion of, is there one final vehicle or three final vehicles? Okay? Some systems say there's three. In other words, some people will follow the hearer vehicle, become an arhat, finished. So other people will follow solitary realizer vehicle, become that kind of arhat, finished. Other people will follow the bodhisattva vehicle, become a Buddha, finished. So there's three final vehicles in the sense that when you complete your vehicle, you're done with what you're doing. Yeah. But then other schools, and these are usually the higher schools, they say, no, actually, there's one final vehicle. The Buddha wants everybody to attain full awakening. That's the final goal. But because not everybody's ready to initially enter the bodhisattva path, he teaches them whatever they're ready to hear and places them in whatever vehicle that is most conducive for them at that particular time in their spiritual development. Okay?
So it's like the strength of his compassion. He really just wants to benefit people. You know, he's not going to say this is the one right way. He's just going to help people in the most pragmatic way.
Well, in the long term, this is the best thing you can do. But in the short term, do this. Okay? It's kind of like, it's like you have a little kid in your backseat, a few little kids in your backseat, and you're driving from here to New York. It's a long drive, okay? There's one kid who's really focused on, I want to see the Statue of Liberty. And all they have in their mind is Statue of Liberty, Statue of Liberty, Statue of Liberty. They are not, every time you see something else on the way, yeah, that's nice, but I want to see the Statue of Liberty. Yeah? then there's another kid in the car that says, you know, Statue of Liberty, I don't know, I can't really relate to it. Yeah, but I saw a picture of the Grand Canyon, and I want to go to the Grand Canyon. Yeah, and Statue of Liberty is very far away. It's so long to sit in the car, you know, and I don't like sitting in the car so long. And you can only count the number of license plates from each state for so long until you get totally bored. Okay, so I just want to go to the Grand Canyon and see the Grand Canyon, and I'll be happy. Okay, so Mom and Dad, you know, that Mom and Dad want to go to see the Statue of Liberty too, but they have this kid that doesn't want to drive across the country. So what do? They say, okay, we're going to go see the Grand Canyon. Yeah. And so they go and see the Grand Canyon. And that's very nice. And then they say, oh, but you know, there's something even better than the Grand Canyon on the way to the Statue of Liberty. Let's go there. You know, maybe they don't even mention the Statue of Liberty, but there's another, you know, we can go to Ohio. There's something. What's exciting in Ohio? You know, you can, yeah, who's from Ohio? You know, we can go to Oklahoma. Where can you go? What can you see in Oklahoma? Big hands at Oral. Okay, let's choose something else. Let's skip Oklahoma. Huh? Michigan. Oh, the Great Lakes. Okay. Yeah, we can go to Michigan. And on the way, we can stop in Chicago. Okay? So Chicago. Then you can see the Loop in downtown Chicago. And you can see what else is in Chicago? The hospital where I was born in. Yeah? You can go see that hospital. Yeah? And so then the kid, you know, who was just at the Grand Canyon says, well, yeah, I'd really like to see the hospital she was born in, you know? That's kind of nice. And Lake Michigan, you know? Yeah, that's good. I hear they have good beaches on Lake Michigan. So, okay, I'll go there. But I'm not going to Grand Canyon, to Statue of Liberty, too far. But then, you know, you get them to Chicago. Yeah. So do you see how you have to be skillful? Yeah. If at the very beginning, when you're still, you know, in Newport, you say, shut up, kid, we're going to see the Statue of Liberty. Yeah. Then, you know, they're going to be screaming the whole ride. Okay. But you get them, you know, you guide them in a skillful way to get them where they're going. And you hold out a little carrot. You know, this kind of the next thing that they can get that's going to make them happy on the way. Okay? So it's in that way that the Buddha will, wants to lead everybody to the final goal of Buddhahood. Okay? But he has to do it very skillfully. Okay? Yeah? I saw a cartoon once where there was a, you know, the parents and the kids in the back seat, and there was the sign Nirvana straight ahead, and the kids in the back seat are going, "Are we there yet?" Yeah, so it's kind of like us, you know. Okay, so let's come back here. So to do this meditation is done to really increase our love and compassion. Yeah, so we've just been doing the 7 points instruction, cause and effect instruction, developing love and compassion there, meditating and equalizing, exchanging self for others. So by now, our love and compassion should be strong, somewhat, or stronger than it was before. So the way to really develop it is to think of taking on others' misery, others' dukkha, with the feeling of compassion, and giving them our happiness with the feeling of love. Okay. Now, some people, just even before starting the meditation, go, I have enough suffering already. I don't want to even think about taking on others. And other people say, well, I can think about taking on others, but I hope the meditation doesn't really work. Because I don't really want to take on others. Okay, so both of these people have some, they're stuck, okay? The first one is just saying, I have enough problems of my own, I don't want to take on others. Yeah, I have too little suffering, too much little happiness myself. I don't want to give away my body possessions and merit. So what would you say to that person? What would you have them meditate on? Kindness of others, yeah. What else? Mm-hmm. Well, what are they missing? When they think like that, what are they lacking?
They could do disadvantages of the self-centered attitude.
Yeah. They're, what are they lacking? Love and compassion. Aren't they? Yeah. Because they're saying, I have enough suffering already. I don't want more. So they don't have compassion, wanting to alleviate others' suffering. And I have too little happiness myself. I don't want to give it away. So their love is low. Okay, so what do they need to meditate on? Yeah, the 7 points of cause and effect, and equalizing and exchanging self and others, and 4 measurables. Yeah. Okay, so before starting this meditation, that person needs to go back and juice up their love and compassion. Yeah, otherwise, you know. Then for the person who says, okay, I'll visualize it, but I hope it doesn't really work. Yeah, what are you going to say to that person?
So one day I was doing giving and taking.
You were?
Doing the giving and taking, uh-huh. The taking and giving. And it came clear in my heart that when I was taking, it was destroying what the resistance, whatever the walls, the difficulty to open that heart to others.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that actually is an example of the meditation working and doing what it's supposed to do.
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah, it came clear in my heart that that was helping my heart to open.
Exactly. Yeah. So the person who's afraid of it, doing the meditation, isn't seeing the benefits of it. Yeah. So they have to think of the benefits of doing the meditation. Yeah. And they also have to realize that this meditation is done in your imagination. And in actual fact, we cannot take on, for example, others' suffering or others' negative karma. Yeah. Because everybody creates their own karma, experiences their own karma. But just the process of imagining that and imagining giving away our body possessions and virtue, just that process has the salutary effect of what you were saying, of opening our own heart and releasing our own resistance. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So it could be the fear of loving, the fear of experiencing pain, whatever kind of fear that is there, that is actually a form of self-centeredness. Yeah. And to realize that they can release that self-centeredness and do the meditation. And they, you know, it's going to have good effects on them if they do it sincerely.
I was wondering in that example where they don't want to end up with the suffering, if you would have them think about fortitude and also about emptiness.
Yeah, I think meditating on fortitude and emptiness would be both of those things would strengthen their mind. Yeah, so that they can see, you know, suffering is not going to destroy me. Yeah. And actually, if they did a little bit of the four establishments of mindfulness, especially mindfulness of the feelings, where you're meditating on painful, pleasant, and neutral feelings, you know, if they have a little bit of that, they also come to see that that those feelings are not going to destroy them. And, you know, those feelings are dependent, they arise from causes, they're impermanent, they don't last forever. Yeah. So what I'm getting at by going into this is when you run into an obstacle in your mind, when you face some resistance to doing a meditation, stop and ask yourself, what is it that I'm thinking or feeling that is the resistance? And what is the Lam Rim meditation or the Lam Rim topic that I need to contemplate to help me get through that and release that resistance? Okay? So we have to think about this, and in this way, we learn to become a doctor to our own mind. Yeah? And that way, when we have a problem, yeah, we know how to meditate to solve our problem. Yeah? We don't just go there and we've heard years and years of teachings, and now we're angry at somebody, and we don't know what to do. Yeah. Come pounding on my door. I'm angry. What do I do? You know, well, I've been telling you what to do for the last 7 years. No longer. you know, to develop this capability ourselves to see what we need to meditate on and to, you know, to be a doctor to our own, you know, infantile, sick mind. Okay. Yeah.
I was reading something by His Holiness, and it suggested doing this meditation. And I was in a really dark space in my life, and I didn't want to do it. I thought, I got enough suffering, just like you're talking about. And I found that one day that I was sick in bed, and I decided to do it anyway. And doing it anyway is what I needed. That's what how I saw the benefits of it immediately, kind of like Venerable Yeshe is saying.
Yeah.
And that seemed to be a great antidote to me, was to just do it anyways. I realized that I wasn't going to, you know, actually take someone's suffering from them.
Yeah. Okay. So this is an interesting thing. Your mind's putting up some resistance, but you say, I'm just going to do it anyway. Yeah. So it's not should, have to, supposed to's guilt. And it's not like, I'm so afraid, I'm so frozen, I clearly can't do it, it's going to destroy me, what do I do? I'm freaking out, da 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 da. It's like, okay, there's some fear, there's some resistance, but I'm just going to do it anyway and see what happens. That's a very nice approach, isn't it? Yeah? You're not letting, you know, the self-centered mind put you in prison. Yeah, and overwhelm you. You're just saying, okay, I have this problem, but let's just do it anyway and see what happens. But it was kind of like me when I was a little kid. I was an extremely picky eater. Yeah, very, very picky. And I did not like salad and I did not like pizza. Those of you who know me well know I eat salad every day and I love pizza. Okay, so there was some transformation that happened in the middle there, you know. But for many years, I just refused to eat salad and pizza. And I guess at some point I must have said, well, let's eat them anyway. And then, you know, realize they were okay. Yeah. So sometimes, you know, just giving ourselves the chance to try something. You know, instead of having the foregone conclusion that I'm not going to like it, so I shouldn't even try it. But I remember as a kid, there were many things I just didn't want to do. And, you know, I did get invited to go here and do that and there and do that. And I don't want to. You know, I don't want to go ice skating. I'll just fall down. I don't want to go horseback riding. I'll fall off. You know, this, that, the other thing. I don't want to. And very often my parents made me, you know. They say, you know, go, you'll enjoy it. No, I won't. I was kind of bratty. And, you know, they made me go. And it was amazing because many things I learned that I did enjoy. You know, it was kind of like, I didn't always want to admit it to my parents afterwards, but, you know, the next time the opportunity came to do that thing, I said, okay, yeah. But, you know, just that thing of, okay, let's give myself a chance instead of getting stuck in a foregone conclusion that I'm not going to like it, it's not going to work, it's not for me. But I've tried some of the foods that you know I don't like, so. Okay, let's get back to what we're doing here. Okay. Yes, our skits are a wonderful opportunity of, I don't want to, but let's do it anyway. Yeah? Yeah. Okay, so when we're taking from practicing the taking part, we're taking from two things, the sentient beings and their environment, okay? And when we're living beings and their environment. And then within living beings, there's, you know, ordinary sentient beings. There we can take from also bodhisattvas on path of accumulation, path of preparation. We can also take from Aryas. Okay, so there's different kinds of living beings that they're all sentient beings, actually. Anybody who isn't a Buddha is a sentient being. So from sentient beings and from their environment. So there's different kinds of sentient beings. Even within the ordinary sentient beings that haven't entered a path, then we have the beings of the six realms, you know, the hell realms and the hungry ghost realm and animal and human and demigod and god realms. Yeah, so we're taking from all those, and we're taking from the environment that they inhabit. And so from sentient beings, there's three things that we want to focus on taking. One is their dukkha. So the three kinds of dukkha. Well, yeah, the three kinds of dukkha. So the dukkha of pain, the dukkha of change, and the pervasive dukkha of conditioning. Yeah, so we want to take those three from the sentient beings. And we also want to, Okay, the three things we want to take from sentient beings are dukkha. Within the dukkha, those are the three branches of dukkha. Then the second thing we want to take from sentient beings are the causes of that dukkha, in other words, the afflictive obscurations. And the third thing we take from them are the cognitive obscurations. Okay? So those are the three things. Now, of course, within this, when you're really meditating, when you start out with the dukkha of pain, well, there's a whole lots of different examples of that. And the dukkha of change, many, many examples of that. You know, so with all these things, there's, you know, I'm just giving you the outline, but within each one, there's many examples and many things to take. So sometimes when you do the meditation, you make big categories, like I'm taking, you know, from all sentient beings, all of their dukkha, okay? And sometimes you do the meditation and you do it in a lot of detail. I'm taking from, the beings in the cold hells, the dukkha of their cold, yeah? And giving them, all the heat and warmth I can, not just from, a heater, but from a kind heart, from a warm heart. Yeah. Because when you think of it, you know, when I think of cold hells, to me, it goes very well with somebody who has a cold heart. Yeah. And cold hells, you can't move, you're frozen. Cold heart, same way. Hot hells, you know, you're screaming all the time, kind of like somebody who has a really bad temper. Yeah, they're overheated with a bad temper. You know, there's like parallels here. You can see them. Okay. Now, within taking from sentient beings, they say that it's very good to start with yourself. So instead of starting with the hell realm, which is going to be really difficult to imagine taking their suffering, you know, because we don't really want to think of the hell realm. We start with ourselves, and we start with very simple things. If you were doing the practice today, think of the kind of dukkha that you could experience tomorrow. Okay? And then you imagine taking that dukkha upon yourself now out of compassion so that you bear it, you experience it now, so that the person you're going to be tomorrow is free of that suffering. Okay? So what are some examples of the dukkha that you could be experiencing tomorrow? Illness. What else? Rotten mood. Okay. Huh? What?
Sore knees.
Sore knees. Okay. What else? Headache. What? Cold. Yeah? Headache, yeah, death, yeah. Okay, frozen toes, falling in the snow. Yeah, people not happy about what I'm serving for lunch, okay? So we could experience, you know, you think of suffering you could experience tomorrow, and then you work up your courage. You take that suffering upon yourself right now. There we were just talking about the suffering of pain. What some of the dukkha of change that you might experience tomorrow? After you were told not to think of bad and good meditation sessions. Maybe having a pleasant feeling in meditation and then staying on your cushion too long so that your body started to hurt and you didn't want to go back for the next session. Something like that. What other dukkha of change could you experience tomorrow? Yeah, enjoying shoveling snow for the first 15 minutes and it doesn't continue. Yeah. What else? So eating too much. Yep. Okay. And then what about the third kind of dukkha, the pervasive dukkha of conditioning? What's some of that that you could experience tomorrow? Yeah, well, just being a human being that has karma that can ripen out of the blue. And things that you didn't expect to happen could happen. Right, creating more karma under that, under the influence of whatever we experience tomorrow. That's certainly dukkha.
So when you're shoveling snow and then you're actually feeling good about it, but then you start wondering how long is that going to last? Is that the suffering of change or the suffering of conditioning?
I would say you have a good feeling at the beginning and then you bring on doubt yourself. I would say it's the second one because you're shifting into a bad mood.
About suffering of the of condition. So would you think of your obscurations or your afflictions and just say...
Yeah, just being a living being with obscurations and afflictions and seeds of karma that are going to ripen. Just that is the pervasive dukkha of conditioning. Okay? Yeah?
The first two sufferings, mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, the third one encompasses the first two. So then you think of this and you imagine yourself, tomorrow's self, and you imagine taking that suffering. Okay? And when you take that suffering, there's different ways to imagine it. Yeah? You can imagine it as pollution coming out of who you are going to be tomorrow. You can imagine it as black light, yeah, that comes out of your right nostril, your future self's right nostril that you inhale through your present self's left nostril, if you want to get really detailed about nostrils and things like that. Or you could just imagine it as pollution that you inhale. And then you think of your self-centeredness and your self-grasping. There are different ways you can think of it. You can think of it as like a pile of dirt. You can think of it as a rock, as a bunch of dust, you know, but something in the middle of your chest that is, you know, that you think is the physical representation of your self-centeredness and your self-grasping. And then as you take on the pollution or you inhale this black light, you know, you imagine that it strikes here at the rock or the lump or the pile or whatever it is and completely demolishes it. Yeah. Some people don't find that kind of visualization appealing. So they prefer maybe to think of it as a lot of dirt in your heart and you're inhaling some kind of special cleaning agent, non-toxic, organic, that's not going to poison you. That is going to remove all that dirt at your heart. She can use, you know, you can adjust the visualization according to what suits you. Okay. So it's actually a very skillful thing because you're taking what, if you start with tomorrow's self, you know, which is in the continuum of who you are now, but it also is not exactly the same person you are now. Okay, so it's easier to take from your future self. But what you're doing is taking what your future self doesn't want and using it to destroy what your present self doesn't want. Yeah, so you're taking their dukkha to destroy your self-centeredness and self-grasping ignorance. Okay, so it's not that you just take on their suffering and then it just sits inside you and you get a stomach ache and, you know, and if all the diseases you were afraid of getting, you now get. No, it's not like that. You know, you take it on, but it gets transformed in a very healing way so that you are completely freed of, you know, the causes of your own dukkha. Okay? So you start with tomorrow's self. Then think about next month's self and the various dukkha you could experience then. And then just think about, you know, if you live to be an old person, the dukkha that you experience then. Yeah, your body hurting, people looking at you like, you know, you're kind of old-fashioned or you're not with it. You know, being forgetful, knowing your days are limited. Yeah, the dukkha of death, you know. Are we ready to face our death and imagine taking on the suffering of dying upon ourselves? Even if it's our own suffering of dying, do we have the fortitude inside to imagine that? Okay, so you do it with yourself for a while. Yeah, and then you progress to people who are close to you. Yeah, friends and relatives who you feel fond of. Then from there you go to neutral beings. Then you, after that, you go to people that you don't trust or don't like, or whatever. And then finally, you do all the different realms of living beings. And so you can go through the different realms one by one, thinking of the different kinds of dukkha those beings experience. And you take that on yourself. And anytime you're taking it on yourself, you're using it to destroy your own self-centeredness and your own self-grasping ignorance. Okay. And so when that comes, that destroys that, then you have an open space in your heart. And within that open, fresh, empty space in your heart, then you can, with love, imagine giving your body, imagine giving your possessions, imagine giving your merit. Okay? So there's lots of detailed explanations to come about how to do all these takings and givings, but I wanted to go over the basic meditation so that each time when I talk about the details, I'm not going to say, you know, do this for yourself tomorrow and then yourself next week and then yourself the rest of the life and then do it for friends and then strangers and then enemies and then all sentient beings in this realm and that realm. Just to have you remember all of that each time I go through a detail. And similarly, you know, that how you visualize when you take it, that you don't just sit there with all their dukkha and causes of their dukkha inside of you, you know, festering like rotten garbage, but it comes and you use it to destroy your own self-centeredness, your own self-grasping ignorance that is that dirt or rock or whatever it is at your heart. And then from that empty space there, you give your body possession and merit by transforming them. Okay? So that's the basic outline before we go in the details. Any questions so far?
I'm wondering about, because it talked about these different kind of dukkha, cause of dukkha, and cognitive obscurations. Mm-hmm. I had the impression that you wouldn't do this for maybe like your teachers.
That you...
Yeah, you wouldn't do this meditation for people who are your spiritual teachers.
Yeah, you do it for all sentient beings.
So it depends how you see your spiritual teachers.
Gensa Jumpa Tekcho says usually we try and see our spiritual teachers with pure view. So he said when it comes to your spiritual teachers, you imagine making offerings to them when you're doing the giving part. Yeah, if you don't see your teacher in pure view, then yes, do that and take on their afflictive obscurations and cognitive obscurations. Yeah, because you don't have to see all your teachers, you know, purely. And sometimes it's hard to.
When we experience a particular kind of suffering, can we meditate that we are taking...
When we experience what?
A particular kind of suffering, like knee pain, for example.
Yeah.
Can we experience that we take all the knee pain?
Yeah, yeah.
So they are free of that.
Right. So this is a very good meditation to do when you have some problem. So when your knees hurt, you think of all the sentient beings who have knee pain, and you imagine taking on all their knee pain, you know? And you think, you know, as long as I'm going through this, may it suffice for all the different people who have pain in their knees. And there's a whole lot of people in this planet who have pain in their knees, you know? Some of them can barely even walk. And so to think, you know, as long as I have that pain, may I take it from others? Yeah. This is always also very good to do when you're in a bad mood. It's like, as long as I'm in a bad mood, may I take on everybody's bad mood? And may everybody be free from their bad moods. Yeah. And then you do the visualization, and you know, it destroys your own self-centeredness, your own self-grasping. So then you have to imagine your own bad mood being gone. Imagine that. No, I don't want to imagine my bad mood going. I like my bad mood. It's so comfortable. Well, this is the whole thing about remembering the teachings and going through them, like I was talking about at the beginning of the session. If we go through all these outlines and do all these meditations, yeah, then when we really need them, we'll remember them and we'll know how to do them. Yeah. But it's very true, you know, right in the, you know, when we're in a bad mood, what do I meditate on? Chocolate. No, sorry, you can't meditate on chocolate. Well, then just give me some. Yeah. No, that's not going to work, you know. So you have to think of how to work with your mind in these different situations. It's like I often say, you know, taught many times, you know, what to do to help somebody who's dying. And, you know, or what to do to help an animal that's dying. Yeah, people have heard it many times. When their animal is dying, when their neighbor is dying, hello, what do I do? Oh, sorry, I did it the wrong way. You don't do this anymore. You do this. Well, so-and-so's dying, what do I do? Yeah, because it's completely gone out of your mind. You know, why is it gone out of your mind when you need it? Yeah, because you didn't go over your notes and contemplate the teachings that you heard. Yeah, so when you don't do that, then, you know, you're at a total loss when something happens. What do I do? Oh, no.
Can you also do the meditation Tonglen for beings in the Bardo when somebody is actually dying and died for some time?
Yeah. Yeah, you can do it for the dukkha of any kind of living being. Yeah, if somebody's dead and you're thinking of them in the Bardo and the confusion they may be experiencing there, yeah. Do taking and giving for that.
Mm-hmm. Is this something that needs to be done in a formal meditation session, or is it something that, like, as, you know, I'm laying in bed with back pain or I'm just walking down the street and thinking of someone that I can do informally too, because I'm always breathing?
Yeah, of course. And you don't always need to do this meditation with the breath either. Sometimes when you do it with the breath, because you're breathing, you don't have enough time to really contemplate and think about it. So I really think until you're very fluent in this meditation, go slowly and don't do it with your breath. Or just imagine the breath after you've, you know, meditated for a while about what this dukkha feels like and what you're taking on yourself, and developing the courage to take it on and really imagining what it's going to feel like for the other person to be free of it. You know, so do that for some time before doing it. And like all meditation, it's good to do, you know, in a meditation session because you have less distraction. But again, like all meditation, do it wherever you are. Yeah, whenever there's the opportunity, whenever there's a situation that fits, you do it. You don't say, you know, oh, my back hurts so much I can't even sit up in bed, so I can't meditate, you know. So I'm just going to lie in bed and feel sorry for myself. No, you can't sit up in bed because something hurts or because you're really sick. Then you meditate lying down. But if you're well, you don't lie down in bed and meditate. Okay? If you're well, you know, I mean, same thing like with sitting on the chairs. If you can, sit on the floor. If you really cannot sit on the floor, then sit in the chair. But don't go to the chair as your first choice. Yeah? So same thing with this, you know. Yeah, try and give yourself the best environment, but do it wherever you can and wherever it fits. Okay.